welcome to the JSGC podcast. We're taking a brief departure today from our usual approach of talking through policy topics in Pennsylvania, and we're going to spend our time talking to a fellow legislative service agency. I'm Susan Elder, and today I'm here with Glenn Passowitz, our executive director here at Joint State.
Hello, Susan.
And Brian DeWalt, who is our sound engineer and co-host.
Hello.
And our guest today is Pat Berger, who is the executive director of Legislative Budget and Finance Committee.
Hi, Susan.
Hi, Pat. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Pat, can you tell us about yourself, where you started, and then how you came to be executive director of the Legislative Budget and Finance Committee?
Oh, absolutely. I went to law school at Dickinson School of Law in Carlisle and was hired out of law school as counsel with the Legislative Budget and Finance Committee. And as counsel, I serve on projects answering legal questions that might come up on a study, as well as assisting with general office matters. I then was promoted to senior counsel when senior counsel, who was there at the time, left. And then when an opening came for a project manager, I became senior counsel responsible for other legal staff, as well as what I was talking about before, and then project manager, where I would then be responsible for managing analysts as well as legal staff, but analysts on a specific project or projects. When our prior director retired at the end of 2017, I was promoted to executive director beginning on January 1, 2018.
Okay. We're the proud employer of some Dickinsonian legal people as well.
So, Pat, can you give us a little bit of history or background about LBFC?
The Legislative Budget and Finance Committee is a statutorily created legislative service agency. It was established on August 4th, 1959. We're bipartisan and bicameral. By that, I mean six of our members are Republicans, six members are Democrats, six members are from the House, and six members are from the Senate. So, obviously, we have 12 members on our committee. Of that, we have four officers, and they each represent one of the caucuses. So we are truly bipartisan and bicameral in the way our committee functions. The committee in the 1960s was more directly involved in the budget process, providing budgetary information to the Appropriations Committee and answering questions that may have come up during the appropriations hearings. From that, it developed more into an agency that went out of the office and did surprise visits at different agency facilities and to write reports and make comments on that. Then comes the early 1970s when the General Accounting Office at the federal level released its Yellow Book. The Yellow Book is a set of standards for government auditing, and it speaks to performance auditing, which is different from financial auditing. At that point, the Budget and Finance Committee function became more of a legislative oversight function, focusing on performance auditing and performance evaluations. Then in 1981, the Sunset Act was adopted. The Sunset Act established a review process that involved the Legislative Budget and Finance Committee doing an audit using specific standards set in the act and looking at the programs or the agencies that were specifically listed in that act. I believe there were 70 to begin with, a lot of them being Department of State licensing boards. So that act actually sunsetted in 1991. But since then, we do performance audits, primarily studies of issues that may be in front of the General Assembly, and then we released our reports at public meetings of our committee.
Pat, did I hear you say there was a time when your office did surprise visits to agencies, to other agencies? Did I understand that correctly?
Yes, and I have that. That was from like the mid-1960s. When they would just, this is nothing I was involved in.
It was nothing that you, during your time.
Not during my time. Although during the time that I've been with the committee, we have gone, when we did a study of the Liquor Control Board back in, it was part of Sunset, and I think it was in the late 80s, possibly very early 1990 or so, where we had staff drive into another state and sit in a parking lot at one of their liquor stores to see how many license plates were from Pennsylvania to try to make the type of judgment as to whether there was an issue or not with that. Oh, there.
Now that's a survey.
Yeah, there were some interesting things. Another thing, when we were looking at state sales tax and whether it's being appropriately applied, we sent staff out to different stores, mainly grocery stores, and purchase different items and then see if they were being appropriately taxed. As you may know, certain products are taxed that are in the store and other products aren't, even though they seem very similar in nature. Certain hygiene products, for example. So yeah, we've done some hands-on stuff that can be pretty fun, actually.
Interesting staff field trips.
And that does bring up something that I think is sort of interesting. We've talked to a couple of the other service agencies, and although they have changed over the years with how they do their work, Legislative Reference Bureau certainly changed its process with computers. Legislative data processing, obviously, with all the computer developments, is constantly upgrading. But LBFC, you really changed your mission from era to era, going from the surprise inspections to, you know, performance audits. I mean, you're starting out doing budgetary, you know, answering questions about appropriations. So that's really interesting how the mission has changed over the past 50 or 60 years or so.
Well, and using the statutory authority that we're provided. So we're able to move into, as you put, where the interest of the General Assembly moved, our statute gave us the authority to move in that direction. We have the authority to look at revenues and expenditures of the Commonwealth. So looking at whether an agency is performing its function well and cost effectively certainly is covered by that type of statutory language.
So Pat, here at Joint State, we get our work primarily via resolution from either the House or the Senate. We have certain projects that are in statute, but mostly they come to us through resolution. What is the process that brings work to your office? How do you decide what topics you're going to be tackling?
Well, similar to Joint State Government Commission, we receive projects by resolution and by statute. Sometimes the statutory projects are once and done. We're currently working on actually what's ready to go out the door this Wednesday is a report on pharmacy benefit managers. But that was a once and done project. Whereas we also have cyclical projects in statute. For example, every 3 years, we're required to do a performance audit of the Fish and Boat Commission. So again, through statute, it can be a once and done or it can be cyclical. And then we also get projects through resolutions. Right now, I'm thinking it's about half and half. Usually it was much heavier on resolutions. But what happens, what's different with a statute and a resolution, when a statute's enacted, we as staff begin working on it when we have staff available to. However, when a resolution is adopted by one chamber, that resolution then goes to our officers. If you recall, our officers represent the four caucuses. And then our officers choose whether to adopt that project. In general, they do, but there are times when they haven't. It's very infrequent, but it has happened.
So, Pat, what you're saying is that sometimes there are project ideas that the executive committee rejects, even though they've been adopted by the House or Senate.
By a single chamber. I'll give you an example. A few years ago, there was a project adopted to have us more or less update, I believe it was a 2005 study that PennDOT had done regarding passenger rail service between Harrisburg and Pittsburgh. And that particular study was done by a consultant, and it got to a level of detail of gratings and the type of rolling stock you would need and a level of detail and a level of expertise that our staff wouldn't have. Therefore, we would have had to hire a consultant to do it. Well, at the time, I did a very quick calculation of what it might cost us based on what the study cost in 2005 and then just doing a cost of living type adjustment to it. And it was a large portion of our budget. And our officers just went back to the prime sponsor and said, if you can come up with the money, we'll go out and get a consultant. But we were not able to do it at that time for that reason.
So then your executive committee put it to a vote.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an official process to it.
Yes. Our officers meet at a sunshine meeting and make those decisions. It's not a staff decision whether we do a project. the information that I provide to the officers would be, do we have the expertise to do it on, you know, with our staff, or do we have to go out and hire a consultant? And we have hired consultants in the past. It's just, we generally try to do it with in-house staff. The other question comes up is, do we have anyone available to begin the project? A lot of times, and I'm sure Glenn has this same situation, we have more projects than we have staff who can start them. So we end up with a queue basically and have to get to them as we can. I usually, when I talk to prime sponsors about the resolutions, I always ask them to give us as much time as possible with the understanding that if we can get it done sooner, we absolutely will. But the problem is you can juggle just so many projects with a small staff.
So can you give us a little bit of an idea when a project has headed your way? So it's either the statute has been passed or the resolution has passed and it lands in the LBFC lap. What happens then? What's your staff process or what's your approach?
In both cases, whether it's a statute or resolution, we'll look at the project and we'll come up with our scope and objective statement. And the scope is going to be the term that we're going to look at. Are we looking at 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, whatever the case may be? We tend to look at 5 years in general. That's kind of our default because we think it gives us a better understanding of trends and finances. Now, I will say COVID has kind of thrown a little bit of a wrench in the works with some of that, but that's generally what we do. We determine what the scope is. Sometimes that's spelled out very specifically in a statute or very specifically in a resolution. Then the other thing we do is our objectives. So a resolution may have 10 things they want us to look at, but when looking at them, it really, you know, there are like three things that need to be done. Usually the third is make recommendations that, you know, we find necessary based on the information that we found. But after we do that, we will contact the agency or the program folks. We send in what we call engagement letters to them. We also send letters to the standing committees with jurisdiction over that particular subject matter to let them know we're starting the project. And if they have any comments, questions, or whatever, to please get in touch with us and we'll try to address them as we're doing our work. And then we also put together a work plan. Once we have a scope and objectives, we've notified folks, we then put together our work plan, which some of it's kind of the generic things you do, you know, you do your background work, and then you start working the specific areas to address the objectives of the particular project. We reach out to pretty much everyone and anyone who wants to talk to us on a project. Doesn't mean that what they tell us is necessarily going to drive our work, but we gather as much data and information as we can. And then from there, we sift it through and produce our reports.
Pat, I've read that since you took your position in 2018, that your office has won 5 national awards. I was wondering if you could tell us about those.
Oh, sure. Our agency belongs to the National Legislative Program Evaluation Society, which is a staff section of the National Conference of State Legislatures. The staff section has several awards, and the one you're referring to specifically is the Impact Award. And what the Impact Award looks at, what the criteria are, is after the report has gone out the door, basically what has happened. And some of the things that you need to show in order to receive that award is, were your recommendations implemented? And that can be by the agency, because it's one of the things we try to do is make recommendations at the lowest level possible. So if an agency can make a change to their process that would improve it, that's where we make the recommendation. So an agency might make a change. Certainly the General Assembly may enact legislation that we recommend. If there's coverage in the news media, not just an article stating that the report was released, it has to be an article that actually uses the report and possibly, you know, a series of articles on that subject matter that uses the report. Or if another agency or entity uses the methodology in the report and cites to the report as part of what they use. So those are some of the criteria. And I'm very proud of that. We've won it more than that, but I'm very proud that the last 5 years that I've been director, each year it's been awarded.
Previously, you mentioned you make recommendations at the lowest level possible. That sounds incredibly difficult just because you're kind of coming in fresh to the topic. So I was wondering if you could speak a bit more about that.
Oh, absolutely. This gives me the opportunity to tell you that we have a terrific staff, very bright, very capable, and able to come up to speed on subject matter very quickly. We've had projects that have been used by the agency to train new staff. They've used our reports to explain processes, because one of the things we need to be able to do in our report is write it for the layperson, so at a level that a layperson can understand, but with enough detail and understanding that individuals who are deeply involved in that subject matter can see that we understood that level of detail.
I think that challenge resonates with us. We're all kind of shaking our heads here. Yes.
And the recommendations, I mean, we get to that point where we know this is a problem with the process that the agency uses. We found that the real hiccup here is their own regulation, that the statute doesn't require a change. We learn this stuff in such detail and go in the weeds, as it were, that we are then able to make those types of recommendations. But I found over the years that it's sometimes easier to get an agency on board when you're talking to them about what they have and how it can be improved within the agency itself. And also, as I know you all know, a statutory change doesn't necessarily come quickly. In fact, as an example of that, we did a report in the early 2000s, and 10 years later, a recommendation made in that report was used for a statutory change. So you don't always see things overnight.
I was thinking this is also a good opportunity to tell us a bit more about the staff you have. So can you tell us a bit more about just what kind of positions or backgrounds they're from?
Oh, absolutely. Right now, we have 12 staff members. Three of us happen to be lawyers, but obviously, since I was counsel and senior counsel, I have a law degree, and I am a licensed attorney. We have a licensed attorney who serves as counsel, and then we also have a licensed attorney who is one of our project managers. We have a project manager who's also our deputy executive director, who has a master's in business administration. We have individuals with master's in public administration, master's in public health, individuals with journalism degree, criminology degree. Pretty much what I'm really proud of is we bring in this group of folks with diverse educational backgrounds and everything, and still are able to come up to speed on some very specific projects, very specific information that we need to understand, and we're able to do it. But we're definitely an agency of generalists.
Pat, in your overview, you mentioned that your office uses standards created by the GAO, I believe it was the Yellow Book, and you said that was for performance auditing. I was curious how you guys came to adopt those standards and just how they're used in your everyday process.
Well, in the 1970s, it was a change to, you know, believe it or not, an era of good government and improving government and making things work. And the GAO came out with these Yellow Book standards. And the standards, when I mention a couple of them to you, they're going to just seem like the most obvious things. First, independence. Whoever's working on the project should be independent from the agency, whatever. I shouldn't work on a project if my spouse is the director of that program we're looking at. I mean, obviously, there would be some question, if not actual, you know, lack of independence, certainly it would be viewed that way. And with independence comes objectivity. The idea that we aren't coming at our work with a particular view or a particular conclusion. What we say when we're giving someone kind of the overview of our work is, you know, we follow the data. We follow where the information that we gather takes us. We don't start with a preformed conclusion. And in fact, I think sometimes folks who have given us projects thought our conclusion would go one way and it went the other way, because that's just where the data took us. So it's standards like that that we use. We've taken the Yellow Book standards and we use them as guidance. We're not a Yellow Book agency, just as a note. There's really a distinction there, and it has to do with certain requirements under the Yellow Book that we don't use. but we generally follow the guiding principles in it. And we use their standards a lot of the times when we're crafting our work plans and our reports.
I'd like to follow up a little bit with that idea about how the agencies have used reports to help train new employees and communicate with them over the course of the project. As I understand it, part of your process might even be in your statute, that the agencies have an opportunity to write a response to your report, and that that is included as part of your final report, as there's a section that's dedicated to this is the agency's response. And I'm wondering how that works. You know, is there any controversy? Does it ever get argumentative that they're not happy with what you presented? And then you end up having to include that in your product.
Glenn, you're absolutely right. Twofold, it is in our statute, and it's two pieces of that. First, we are required by our statute to provide a draft copy of the report to the agency prior to it becoming a public document. At that point, the process that we use is really, we want two things out of that. If we've made mistakes, you know as well as I do, a number can get switched or something can be misunderstood. We want to get our reports accurate before they go out the door. So one of the value of having an agency do that kind of review is they can point that out to us and we can get that change made before it goes out the door. So that's kind of the informal part of that review. But the second part of it is, as you said, if they provide us a formal response, a written response, by statute, that has to be attached to the report. And in our reports, it becomes an appendix to the report. And in answer to your question, sometimes they get pretty argumentative. And in a couple of cases, we have had to do a response to the response, which we then also include in the report. Now, the good news here, though, is in general, the agency responses fall into, I'm going to say, three categories. One is the thank you for letting us see the report. We'll certainly take a look at your recommendations and consider them in the future. You know, some very quick response. Then there's the some agencies go into a little bit more detail about which recommendations they agree with, which they don't, where they agree with our findings and conclusions and that, and where they don't. And possibly they use it as their own opportunity to advocate to the General Assembly for changes that maybe didn't come up. Possibly it was outside our scope and objectives that they would like to see. So they use it that way. And then the third is the, we disagree with you and you missed the boat. And, oh, we've been told by an agency that we weren't engineers, which frankly we knew, and told them that at the beginning of the process, saying we weren't going to be making determinations as to whether something should or shouldn't have been done. We were looking solely at the process. If it was supposed to take 10 days, did it take 10 days? You don't need to be an engineer to do that.
So have there been reports that have not gotten approval from the executive committee to be released?
There was a report, and I can really only speak for the time that I've worked with the agency. So prior to the mid-80s, I can't answer that question. But I recall one project, and I believe it had to do with workman's compensation. And this is back in the, I'm going to say late 80s, early 90s. And we discussed it at our meeting. Maybe it would help if I explain how our reports are released. So we finished our report. We've sent it to the agency. We have their response. We now have our final document. The Legislative Budget and Finance Committee will meet in public. And at that point, a member of our staff, usually the project manager, will provide testimony about the report, basically a, let's say, 5 to 8 minute summary of the document and what we found and what our recommendations were. And then if there's a member of the agency there, representative from the agency, they'll be asked to join our staff person at the table when we're doing this in person. And our members get to ask questions of both our staff and then the agency staff. After that is done, the chair will take a vote to release the report. So at the meeting I was talking about regarding workers' unemployment insurance, we went through that first part. We had the testimony that summarized what was in the report. We had answered questions on the report. And when the vote came to take it, the vote was to hold the report. I have no idea why, but the vote was taken to hold it. However, at the next meeting, The report was voted to be released, and no changes were made to it between the first meeting and the second meeting. Other than that, as far as I can recall from my time, all reports that were discussed at a public meeting became public documents and were released. We have two projects we're working on now that are actually scheduled to go out the door in 2 days on January 25th. The first one was a statutory project I mentioned earlier on pharmacy benefit managers, and that's looking specifically at pharmacy benefit managers in the managed care medical assistance program that's operated by the Department of Human Services. The other project we have going out at the same time is pursuant to a resolution, and that's looking at rural dental services. Another project that we're just starting up is another resolution, and it's looking at some proposed changes to DEP permits and looking at the potential cost and consequences of those changes. And we are working on another project pursuant to resolution, looking at the PennDOT's maintenance funding for their maintenance districts.
Glenn, I think we have time for one final question, if there's anything else you want to bring up.
Pat, how would you state the mission of LBFC, the reason why you do the work that you do?
Well, like I said earlier, we follow the data, and I believe the mission of our agency is to provide the members of the General Assembly with timely, because we all know if you don't get the information out there timely, it's not always useful, but timely, accurate, and unbiased information analysis and performance evaluation to inform their policy decisions. And I think that's the key. Once we complete our report, and like I said, we've gone where the data has led us, we've made the recommendations that we feel are supported by what's in our report and are defensible, it's really up to someone else to move those recommendations forward. We do not advocate for our work when it's done. I always tell members of the General Assembly, I won't be showing up on your doorstep asking you to make this change. That's really up to someone else to do. We believe our work is done when we hand off that report, although we've been asked to provide testimony at other committee meetings. We've done that. If a member wants us to come over and discuss a report in more detail, obviously we'll do that. We provide information to stakeholder groups if they ask us to come and talk about the report. But all of this is after the report's gone out the door. Prior to that, as I've said before, it's confidential.
It's time for us to wrap up our podcast today. So thank you so much for joining us, Pat, and giving us some more insight into the workings of the Legislative Budget and Finance Committee.
Absolutely.
To learn more about Legislative Budget and Finance Committee, please see the link to their website in our show notes. And in the show notes, you'll also find a link to our website. We have all the past podcasts, and you'll find a discussion with all of our sister legislative service agencies. So we've spoken with Legislative Reference Bureau, Legislative Data Processing, Capital Preservation, and also the Center for Rural Pennsylvania. The music in our podcast is provided by Joseph McDade. Thanks for listening and have a nice day.